There's a rum bond at the end of I think that's where it is. And sometimes people quote that, that the rum bond said that mitzvahs don't apply in chutzlar.
The rum bond says what?
The rum bond says that mitzvahs don't apply in chutzlar.
Yeah.
It seems like it's either taken out of context or misunderstood.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, the Ramban does not say you don't do mitzvahs in chutz laretz. What the Ramban says is this: the Ramban quotes a chazal that even Rashi quotes, that says that Hashem told us in Golos we should keep the mitzvahs so that we will remember what to do when we come back to Eretz Yisrael. So the Ramban says that indicates that although Hashem commanded that we keep those mitzvahs in Chutz La'aretz, but the inherent spiritual value of them is really only in Eretz Yisrael, and in Chutz La'aretz it's a getter of chinuch and a reminder. And he points out that in Chutz La'aretz we're under the control of mazalos, intermediate angels. Like God has an undersecretary of state for America and for England and for France and for Germany, and in Eretz Yisrael you're directly under the hashgacha of Hashem. So, which means the Ramban is saying, I do put on tefillin in Chutz La'aretz, but the spiritual value of tefillin is realized only in Eretz Yisrael. Now, you know, there's a general machlokas that the Ramban does count living in Eretz Yisrael as one of the 613 mitzvos. The Rambam doesn't count it, so many Meforshim understand that the Rambam holds it is not a mitzvah per se, but that's really separate from that passage. So the Ramban does say that, but Chas v'Shalom, the Ramban would not say you don't keep mitzvahs in Chutz La'aretz. Now, just one question. People ask the obvious question. You know, the Ramban lived in Spain, Catholic Spain, almost all of his life. And the only reason he went to Eretz Yisrael, Saif Yamav, which he did do, was because he was kicked out of Spain because he was engaged in a debate regarding the defense of Judaism versus Christianity. And in those days, it was like a popular contest that people would vote who was the winner of the debate. And the good news is the Ramban was the winner of the debate. The bad news is he insulted the church, so the punishment was exile. The good news for that was that he came to Eretz Yisrael. The question is, if he holds that Zechi of the Oraisa to live in Eretz Yisrael, why did he not go until he was kicked out? And, you know, we don't really know, but there are two possible answers. One is that to travel in those days to Israel was literally a matter of life and death. It was pikuach nefesh. You had animals, you had pirates, you had, you know, armies. It was very, very dangerous. And number two, the Ramban was the Gadol Hador, and in those days communication between Eretz Yisrael and Europe was not very good. And the Ramban was needed, right? The Ramban was needed to be where he was, and that was Doha. But Miyikar Adin, the Ramban does say Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah di arising.
At the end of last time, I asked about like science and the Gemara.
Yes. The issue is this. The issue is that throughout Gemara, we have Chazal's observations on science and the like, and sometimes those observations and those descriptions don't fit contemporary understandings of science. For example, it's very clear from a number of Gemaras that Chazal believed in spontaneous generation. That means that life can come out of dead matter. Chazal say you're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos, because the prohibition of killing is only when a creature was produced by sexual reproduction. And lice, the Gemara says, are not produced from sexual reproduction. They are produced from spontaneous generation of decaying matter. And therefore, Chazal matired what would be an Isser D'Oraisa based on something that modern science says is not true. Modern science says lice certainly reproduce sexually. There is Mr. and Mrs., they might be tiny, etc., but they do reproduce in that way. So the question becomes this. We really have to divide it into two categories. One is, what is the validity of a scientific observation that Chazal make that does not affect halacha? Just, you know, you learn the Gemara, talk about medicine, science. Are we obligated to accept that as true? The second is, when it affects halacha, does the halacha change if the science changes? Or do we say the science is wrong and the halacha doesn't change. So with respect to the first, when Chazal make a pure scientific observation, and it does not affect halacha, it is just a scientific observation. So there, going all the way back to the Rambam and Rav Haigon, even earlier to Rav Haigon, there is this idea that when the Chachamim are not speaking Torah, when the Chachamim are simply giving you knowledge about the world, they are speaking as very wise and great people, which they were in all Chachmas, but they were not speaking as the receivers of a sacred tradition coming all the way from Moshe, and therefore a purely scientific observation may or may not be correct. It was basically reflective of the science of the time. I mean, just like Aristotle made statements which, you know, may or may not be true, so the science of Chazal may or may not be true. That is one approach. Now, but that refers to science that is not impacting upon halacha. The case of the louse is a much more complicated, difficult situation, because there, Chazal's scientific judgments actually changed the halacha. And not only did it change the halacha, but it changed the halacha in the direction of leniency. So how can that be a true halacha? So here we have many, many approaches in the Mefarshim. Some Mefarshim say, if halacha said a rule based on erroneous science, when the science changes, the halacha does change. This was the view of a very early Acharon, the Pachad Yitzchak, not to be confused with Rav Huttner, who is the later Pachad Yitzchak. But this was an Italian rabbi, who was a well-regarded posek, and he said, it is usur min haTorah to kill a louse today, because we know that the reason Chazal gave was erroneous. Now, this is a theologically difficult position, and many, many poskim reject it, because they say, you're now telling me that Chazal can be mistaken not only on matters of pure science, but Chazal can be mistaken on halakha. And that can't be. That would be a contradiction to their status as Balei Mesorah. So here we have a Mahalach, so I'll give you two Mahalachim that say the halacha does not change even if the science changes. One is a Mahalach of the Chazon Ish, and the other is a Mahalach of Rav Dessler. The Chazon Ish's Mahalach is actually very, very interesting. The Chazon Ish's Mahalach is the following. The dinim of the Torah do not depend on objective reality, it depends on perceived reality. What do I mean by that? The Torah says, for example, you're not allowed to eat insects. Well, or, you know, organisms. That's why people go crazy with strawberries and broccoli and everything else and the like. I mean, you wonder, based on what you're told you cannot eat today, I mean, you wonder how the Jewish people physically survived after they stopped having mun. I mean, like there's nothing you can eat. Now, the problem is, every time you open up your mouth, every time you take a glass of water, there's all sorts of stuff in here. You don't want to know. There's all sorts of stuff in here that you're taking in that's absolutely treif. But what is the rule? The rule is very pashut, that even if there are some, you know, insects here, if they're microscopic, and if they're not visible to the eye, the Torah does not aser. The Torah doesn't aser insects. The Torah asers visual insects. That which is not nikar liayin, even though under a microscope I would be able to identify them, they are not prohibited. Tefillin. The bias of tefillin has to be square. Okay, it has to be square. So if it's not a 90 degree angle, if the angle is crooked, your tefillin are pasul. Now, the halacha is, sometimes you can get a measuring tool to measure if it's 90 degrees, and you might see that your tefillin is only, you know, 89 and a half degree angle, or whatever it is. But the halacha is no. You look at it, if an average person, it looks like square, you're not mechuyev to go to a microscope or a measuring tool or a compass or anything like that, because the phenomena of the Torah are based on what is visual and perceptible to human eyesight, and you don't go beyond that rule. Now, the Chazon Ish argues the following. When Chazal said that lice do not produce sexually, they were not describing an objective reality. They also knew that there is sexual reproduction at a subvisual level. But they're basically saying, since the definition of halachic phenomena are based on visualization, if visually it appears as if there's spontaneous generation, then this is not going to be nichlal in the yisr. So it's not a question of erroneous science, the Chazon Ish says. It is a question of what is perceptible to the human sensory input. Now, that doesn't answer every question. That answers specifically the lice issue. But Rav Dessler gives an approach that is very, very broad and will really address everything. Rav Dessler says the following. Rav Dessler says that because the Torah is infinite, and because when Chazal interpret the Torah, they are acting through Ruach HaKodesh, the rulings that they issue are in accordance with the divine will, even if the particular reasons that were perceptible at the time proved to be false. Just like Lahavdil, people say, the reason why you're not supposed to eat pork is because pork carries diseases, trichinosis, and the like, and that's why they'll tell you today that we have refrigeration and we have better ways of cooking. There's no reason to keep kosher. I don't know if people make this argument anymore, but this was a very, very well-known argument against the laws of kashrus. Now, the answer is this. The answer is, it may very well be that one of the reasons for keeping kosher is that it promotes health. That's not necessarily a false reason, but it's certainly not the only reason. There are infinite reasons for the divine wisdom. Sometimes we discover them, sometimes we don't discover them. Sometimes we discover new reasons that might have been unknown to earlier generations because God factored in all of that infinity. Rav Dessler says there may be a gazillion reasons why you're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos. Chazal identified a reason based on their scientific knowledge of the time. But even if that proves to be erroneous, the assumption still is their psak is right and eternal, even if their reason is wrong. Which means, according to Rav Dessler, it is entirely possible that the science might be erroneous, but that has no impact on the halacha, because the halacha is the ratzon Hashem, even for reasons that Chazal themselves either didn't know or didn't identify, and they did know, meaning they could have known many, many reasons, and they just gave us the tip of the iceberg. That's what Rav Dessler says. This is reminiscent, by the way, of a very famous story involving Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Now we're fast-forwarding into the 1900s. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the great Rav Chaim of Brisk, was known as the deepest, most analytical thinker of all of the Gedolim, right? The Rav Chaim's Derech Halima. But Rav Chaim didn't like to paskin halacha. He was the Rav of Brisk, but he hated to paskin. He didn't want to paskin halacha. We can go into all sorts of interesting reasons why he didn't want to paskin. So the Posek Hador in Rav Chaim's Tekufa was a man, Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, who was considered to be the greatest posek in Russia at the time. In fact, YU is named after him. It's called Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Yochanan. Yitzchak Yochanan was really the posek ador. And so the legend has it, I'm not sure if it's a true story, but the legend has it that when Rav Chaim would send shailas to Rav Yitzchak Yochanan, he would always tell him, please just give me a psak. Tell me yes or no. Do not give me any reasons. Why? Because Rav Chaim said, you'll give me a reason, I'll slug it up, I'll argue with it, I'll see it differently, but I know that because you're the Posek Hador, whatever your psak is Hashem's answer, even if you don't even know the reason for it. Meaning, the psak is the Ratzon Hashem, independent of the ability to perceive the actual reason. Rav Dessler is saying a similar thing, even when Chazal based their rulings on science. Now, there are two other comments I'll make which don't necessarily answer the question. One is the idea that, hey, who says, I mean, why am I assuming, right, you might consider me as being too much of a devotee of science. Why am I assuming that when science contradicts Chazal, science is by definition right, and we just have to find some way to salvage Chazal? Who says? Science might be wrong, right? Evolution, all sorts of things. Science might be totally wrong. And Chazal had a deeper understanding of a Metzius that science will come to at a later time, right? That's another approach, meaning to say, like, who says that we have to assume science is right and then say, well, okay, Chazal's reason is wrong, but there are other reasons. Maybe science is wrong. The second idea is an idea of the Maral, which doesn't answer everything. But the Maral says the following. The Maral comments on a Gemara in Sukkah that some of you might have learned, the Gemara in Sukkah, that talks about why are there eclipses in the world. You know, an eclipse when the sun gets blocked, when the moon gets blocked. So the Gemara says the reason why there are eclipses is because of various sins that people commit, and that causes the sun to be blocked out. So the Maral says people make fun of that. People say, well, we know why there are eclipses. This is part of the normal revolution of the sun and the earth and the planets, and you can predict eclipses thousands of years into the future. Who says there are going to be sins at that particular time and place? So the Maral says an important yesod, that Chazal knew the science of all this, and Chazal knew that eclipses are predictable, they're part of a cycle, it's because of the rotation of the earth and the revolution of the earth around the sun and everything else. But when Chazal described causes of phenomena, they are not looking at physical causes. They are looking at spiritual causes. By that we mean the following. You know, to say that something happens because of the laws of astronomy or physics is begging the question, because Hashem could have made other laws of astronomy or physics. Instead of saying something falls, like an atheist will say, the reason why if I drop a pen, it falls is because there is a law of gravity, nothing to do with God. But why, you know, that doesn't mean anything. Yeah, there are scientific laws, but God could have made the law of gravity working in the opposite way. God could have said, when you drop something, it goes up, or it goes sideways, or sometimes it does this, sometimes it does that. So when Chazal say eclipses happen because of sins, they're really asking a deeper question. Chazal made the laws of astronomy such that there would be these cycles of eclipses, because God knew ahead of time when there would be these, it's an amazing thing, when there would be these sins, when there would be these averas, and the whole scientific structure of physics was based on that particular phenomenon. So the Maral says, again, this is a partial answer for certain conflicts, that you sometimes have to understand that when Chazal gives spiritual explanations for things, they are not negating the scientific explanation. They are simply saying why God created that scientific structure. Now, the truth of the matter is, the Chumash itself follows that Mahalach. The Chumash says, why are there rainbows? There are rainbows, as it were, kavyachol, to remind Hashem that he will no longer bring a flood upon the earth. Well, a scientist would say, what do you mean? We know why there are rainbows, that when there are drops of water, water vapor in the air, and light strikes the water drops in the air, the water drops are like a prism that breaks white light into different colors. And that's why you see different colors. It has nothing to do with sins, and it has nothing to do with reminders not to destroy the world. Rainbows are the normal refraction of light when it hits water. But what is the answer? The answer is Pashut. That's 100% true. Rainbows are created because light gets refracted into different colors of the spectrum when it hits water, it's water drops or glass or a prism or the like. But the point is, why did Hashem make a world having those physical attributes? He could have, you know, why is it that white light, it breaks up when it hits raindrops? The answer is because that was the mechanism by which Hashem gets reminded, so to speak, whatever that means, not to destroy the world. Okay, so that's the Maral's perspective, that Chazal are looking at ultimate causes, and science looks at immediate, proximate causes. Okay, so there's a lot of different aspects to this. Yeah?
I was wondering if the Rav could give us a way of understanding the fact that many of the Gedolim of the time told their communities to stay in Europe despite the imminent, you know, threat of the Nazi invasion. And, you know, a lot of people stayed on that advice, and a lot of people were killed. How do we understand that?
Yeah, well, you know, it is very, very difficult to understand. First of all, it is important to know yesh v'yesh. There were many gedolim that told people to leave. But there are a few different possibilities here. One possibility is that the Holocaust was perhaps the epitome of what is called a time of hester panim, of concealment of the divine, and a time of rischa, a time of fury. That the Midas Hadin was matuach, it was stretched out on Am Yisrael. The Holocaust was a fulfillment of the curses of the Tochacha. You can mamish look at it almost verse by verse by verse in terms of everything that happened, particularly the Tochacha in the book of Devarim. Now we find at a time of Hester Panim and what is called Idan Rischa, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes takes away the pure wisdom of even the greatest, so that Hashem will bring the onesh that was nigzer. Now, if this sounds like a disrespectful point, let me point out that I am taking this from a Gemara itself. If you remember the Churban of the Bayis Sheni, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, right, was smuggled out to try to negotiate a peace with the Roman general Aspasianus, Vespasian, who then became emperor. Remember that Yerushalayim was under the control of zealots who wanted to fight the Romans? And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was convinced that this would be very destructive, as it was, and he wanted to make peace. And he had to be smuggled out as a dead body, because the Jews would not let him come out. And he finally goes to Vespasian. And Vespasian initially says, why didn't you come earlier? You know, we learned this Gemara in Tisha B'Av. It's a Gemara in the seventh parak of Gittin. I'm sorry, the fifth parak of Gittin. So what eventually happened was that the general was very impressed with Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, and he asked Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, ask for a favor and I'll give it to you. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai asked that the city of Yavne should be spared, the little village of Yavne, so the Sanhedrin could relocate. And he asked for a doctor, for Rav Tzadok, who had fasted for 40 years, that there shouldn't be a destruction of the temple, and Rav Tzadok was very emaciated and sick. And he asked to spare the family of Rabban Gamliel the Nasi. But the Amoraim said, why didn't he ask to spare the Beis HaMikdash? Why didn't he ask? And the Gemara says, quoting the Pasuk, Meshiv Chachamim Achar, there is a time when God confuses even the wisdom of the wise, because it is a time for Hashem's awesome decree to be promulgated. So answer number one is that it is part of the onesh of the Tochacha that the Chachamim might sometimes give advice that is not right. But that's part of the onesh itself. Part of the onesh is the Chachamim lose Chachma. But there are other approaches as well. Let me give you two approaches. Let's look at this. Where should the Chachamim, the Gedolim, told Jews to go? So the two answers, Europe, all of Europe is under war, right? Going to France wouldn't have helped. I mean, France, England, all these countries were under the same Nazi threat. So people say, United States, America, large-scale immigration to America. And the other answer would be Palestine, Israel. Well, let's look at this option. There were many Gedolim who felt, with a great deal of justification, that sending your children to America would almost guarantee they would not be Jews. They would give up their religion. There were very few yeshivas in America. Most European Jews who came to America, the vast majority, gave up Torah, became secular, intermarried, assimilated. It is only since World War II that there really is strong Yiddishkeit in America, not before World War II. Now, this is very harsh to say, but some Gedolim took the position that it is better, as it were, to stay in Europe, even if that creates a risk of our death, than to go to America, where the risk of losing the Torah is even greater. That losing the Torah, losing Yiddishkeit, getting away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is a fate that is worse than death. And therefore they took the position, we will stay here and have rachamim on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Chazal say, Gadol hamachtiyo yosim min ahorga, that if I cause you to sin, it is worse than if I killed you. And therefore they felt America would be machtiyo, Europe is horga, we'll stay put. This is one approach. Now, what about going to Eretz Yisrael? Well, number one, it was hard to go to Eretz Yisrael. Under the British mandate, immigration was very limited. But I once heard another explanation from my own Rosh Hashiva, Rav Yaakov Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha. He was Rav Noach's brother. And he said the following. You know, Hitler himself was invading North Africa, etc. And The only reason Hitler did not go to Palestine is that he was limited in resources, and there weren't enough Jews in Palestine to make it worth his while. The argument goes, had more Jews come to Eretz Israel, then Hitler would have included Palestine in his North African campaign. So to say, oh, people should have gone to Palestine, I'm calling it Palestine because that's what it was called in the 1930s and early 40s. People say, oh, if more Jews would have come to Palestine, they would have been saved from Hitler. It's the other way around. Had there been more Jews in Palestine, it would have been conquered by Hitler. And therefore, keeping the Jews away at that point was a way of ensuring the safety of the Jews that remained in Eretz Israel. So there are all sorts of calculations here that we don't fully understand, but I will go back to the one statement Chazal made, that in times of Hester Panim and in times of Midas Adin, the Chachamim will sometimes give advice that is not correct. That is part of God's plan to carry out the awesomeness of the punishment. Now, you do know that in 1940, again, World War II began in 39, the invasion of Poland, but the Holocaust really began, the concentration camps really began in 1940, 41. 1940, there were three great gedolim who died in the same year. One was Rav Baruch Ber Lebovitch, the great Rosh Hashiva of Kamenetz. The other was Rav Shimon Shkop, the great Rosh Hashiva of Grodno. And the third was Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzensky of Vilna, who was the Gadol Hador. Chavetz Chaim had died before Hitler even assumed power. Chavetz Chaim died in 33. But in 1940, these three Gedolim died, one after another. And many, many people remarked that the Midas Adin of the Holocaust could not begin as long as these Tzaddikim were in the world. And therefore Hashem, who had a Gezerah that this Churban had to take place, had to take the three great Tzaddikim of the generation before the Churban could take place. And indeed, it's Merumas. There's a Pasuk in Treyasar that Hashem says, I will take the three shepherds in 1 year, and then I will bring punishment. And there's a Pasuk, Mamish, that was what happened in 1940. Yeah.
There's some whole idea of Jesus limits us, and you build a sukkah right after Yom Kippur, you cultivate the Torah, you run, whatever you do.
Yep.
But I heard an idea that when you call to be in Shalak Tibur, it depends. Whether you're Shabbos, if you're Shabbos, you're in the position for a kosher person, it's a kosher position. But during the week, since not many people know how to do it, so then you go and do it. It's an honor for you. So what's the correct approach when you ask to be Shalak Tibur?
No, it's a very good question. You are correct. The normal idea is Rizus, rush to do a mitzvah. On the other hand, thank you. Shaliach Tzibur is very, very different, because Shaliach Tzibur is the responsibility not just for your mitzvah, but you're going to be motzi the kehila in Kaddish, in Kedusha, and only a very righteous person, in theory, is supposed to be a Shaliach Tzibur. So for a person to run to that position is considered to be an arrogance and a gaiva, saying that I'm worthy of it, when we're really not worthy of it. So because of that, the Shulchan Aruch says that when you're asked to be a Shaliach Tzibur, you should initially decline. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch says you should be asked twice, decline twice, and then when they ask you a third time, then you go. Now, what's interesting is it's very, very funny, because sometimes, a person wants to be a chazan, although not so much in the center, I notice, but sometimes a person wants to be a chazan, and the gabbai only asks him once, and the person goes, no, can't do it. And the gabbai walks away and says, wait a minute, you didn't ask me another time, etc. So our custom is that we actually don't follow the halacha of actually declining, but nevertheless, symbolically, you should show that it's a bit of reluctance. You shouldn't say, wow, yeah, I'm so excited. You should say, well, no. If you need me, I'll do it. And the reason is because it is a certain gaiva to assume that I could be motzi the tzibur, right? So you basically don't look for that type of honor. Yeah.
Reading the biography of the Oruch Lanier.
Is there a biography of Oruch Lanier? A book?
In the beginning of it's a small.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it said that after in his will he stipulated that the Arba Misos be done to his goat. I was wondering.
Wow.
What is that?
Well, yeah, it's very, very surprising to me. I'm going to have to look at that myself. it's interesting that, you know, the Aruch HaNer was in the 1800s, but if you go back to the 1200s, there was in Germany, Bedavka, in the time of the Rishonim, there was a group of people who were called Chassidei Ashkenaz, the pious ones of Ashkenaz. Not to be confused with the Baal Shem Tov's Chassidim that came later. This is way before the Baal Shem Tov. Rav Yehuda HaChassid, Sefer Chassidim. And they were mystics, they were Mekubalim, pre-Ari Mekubalim, the Sefer Rokeach. And they did incorporate, as part of their Avodas Hashem, the notion of afflicting yourself, you know, going through pain, like, you know, sleeping in the snow, sleeping on thorns. In other words, ascetic practices similar to certain Christian monks and the like. So this was a, you know, Ashkenazic minhag going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It's interesting that the Aruch HaNer, you know, tried to do it as well. Well, the Arba Misos basically means that there are four wet methods of execution, and there was an idea among some Mekubalim that in order to not have those punishments in Shemayim, heavenly stoning, heavenly burning, heavenly strangulation, and heavenly decapitation, whatever that would mean, that you do something to the guf. Now, that doesn't mean mutilate the guf. That would be prohibited, but like stoning. We do that too. You put a stone on the grave, you know, that's considered to be stoning. Burning, you singe a hair during the Tahara. So there was a concept that by physically carrying out these onshin in some way on the body, that would be a spiritual kapara. Now this, I think, comes from the Chassidei Ashkenaz, but I was really not aware that Gedolim were encouraging that Hanhaga at a much, much later time. Now that implies, first of all, that's it, because that implies, that's certainly only Kabbalistic in origin, that implies that the Aruch HaNer was a Mekubal, which is also a Chiddush, a little bit. You know, the Aruch HaNer was Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's Rebbe. I don't know if you know this. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was the great leader who brought back, really, Orthodoxy to Germany. Germany was almost conquered by the Reform movement. Like, you know, 95% Reform. And he turned back the tide, and he built strong Orthodox kehilos in Germany. 100 years before Rav Hirsch, Germany was one of the great places. You had the Pnei Yoshua. You had really, really great, great, great Gedolim. The Aruch HaNer died at the very beginning of the Reform movement, and the Aruch HaNer was said to be the last, what do they say, it's hard to describe it, but the last traditional type of Gedol that Germany had. Rav Hirsch already had to deal with modern types of problems. The Aruch HaNer was still the old-fashioned Gedol, so to speak. But the Aruch HaNer did write one of the earliest responsa on the Reform movement, and a very important psak that many people still use today, particularly in Or Sameach, other Bali Tshuva institutions. And that is the whole issue of whether if somebody is a Mechalel Shabbos and they touch wine that is not Mevushel, we know if a non-Jew touches the wine, you're not allowed to drink it. And we generally know that a Mechalel Shabbos, Befarhesia, is halachically like a non-Jew, and you can't drink the wine. So can I drink wine if somebody doesn't keep Shabbos? So the Aruch HaNer paskin that members of the Reform movement were like kidnapped babies. They were not, the children of the new generation were not fully responsible, unlike the rabbis and the leaders, because they simply never knew better. And that is a leniency that we still, not everybody, Rabbi Yashiv was actually Machmir, but at least in our world, we are by and large fairly makel, based on the Aruch HaNer's idea. In fact, you don't realize what a Chorban it was. You know, I read a memoir once of a boy whose father had been an Orthodox rabbi, and they just decided to go with the Reform movement. I mean, they were Frum, and they decided, let's be Reform. And the boy describes, the boy wrote this when he was 60 years old, but he described, when we were a little boy, my mother said one day, we're going to go to the treif butcher, to the non-kosher butcher today. And he describes this whole process of how his mother is shaking and quivering when she has to make this momentous break to walk into the treif. I mean, he's describing like it's such a dramatic moment in which the mother is looking around, is somebody watching, etc. And she orders the pork. And she was gagging on it, but she said, we have to do, I mean, Mama Chas V'Shalom, looking at it like Mesiras Nefesh, we have to be Moser Nefesh for this cause. And this is what it was. I mean, the attraction of reform was so overpowering that people who didn't even want to do it felt they have to do it. They have a chiyuv to go in that direction. It was an awful thing. Just about Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch was a chief rabbi of a province in Germany, of Oldenburg. And Frankfurt, which had been the greatest Jewish city in Germany, this was the Chassam Sofer was from Frankfurt, Rav Nosson Adler was from Frankfurt, the Hafla, Sefer HaKesuvos was from Frankfurt, the Pnei Yoshua was from Frankfurt. But Frankfurt was totally controlled by the Reform movement. The number of Orthodox Jews in the Kehillah was less than a minion, nine families. And the nine families wanted to create some type of structure. So they invited Rav Hirsch to be their rabbi. Now, it's pretty much of a crazy thing. They didn't expect him to say yes. I mean, Rav Hirsch had a position, a prestigious position, and they invited him to be the rabbi of nine families. But he saw this as a message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he can bring Frankfurt back to be a Makom Torah and Kedusha. And he started the Kehillah in Frankfurt, Kahal Hadas Yeshurun, which is the name of the German Kehillah in Washington Heights, which is a successor, a post-World War II successor of the Kehillah in Frankfurt. So, just to know a little bit about Rav Hirsch. Yeah?
I was wondering, what's a better thing to do if you have some spare time and you're waiting by a bus stop? Is it still better to learn a small sign or do Tehillim during a sign?
Well, both of them are very good. And in fact, let me just mention, since our Reis Sora is Bedafka Yishmael, it is brought down in many Svarim that the primary way we attack Yishmael is through the Koach HaTorah. How do I get that? Because Yishmael is called a Chamor. Am HaDomel L'Chamor. There's another Chamor in the Torah, the Chamor of Kedusha. Shevet Yisachar is called Chamor in Yaakov Avinu's blessing. Yisachar Chamor Garim. Chamor beats Chamor. Now, why is Yisachar called a donkey? Because like a donkey, it bears the burden and the yoke of Torah learning. So Torah learning against Malchus Yishmael is a great, great koach. Perhaps even greater. We need tefillah, but Torah might even be greater than tefillah bedafka against this particular enemy. But I would basically say, therefore, that Torah would be best, but it all depends on your ability to concentrate. Sometimes it's more difficult to concentrate at a bus stop, and if Tehillim would enable greater concentration, then you go with that. So you would go where your concentration, I mean, Torah, if both are the same, I would say Torah. If the concentration is less in the learning because it's hard to concentrate, then go with Tehillim. By the way, just to give you that, you know, the Brisker Rav and all of his family, they would say Tehillim all day on Rosh Hashanah. After davening, they would just say Tehillim. And somebody once asked the Brisker Rav, you know, all right, Tehillim, I understand. People are not learned, they say Tehillim, but wouldn't it be better to take out a Gemara and spend hours of Torah learning? Why are you saying Tehillim all day? And the Brisker Rav actually said an interesting thing. This wouldn't answer your question directly, but the Brisker Rav said that, you know, learning is the better thing to do. And when I was younger, the Brisker Rav said I would learn. But with learning, there's going to be a lot of interruptions. You get up to get a sefer. You get up to do this, to do that. And when there's interruptions, somebody asks you something, etc., you don't have what is called ritzifut. You don't have continuity. And he said Rosh Hashanah as a Yom HaDin, it's so important that you try not to waste a minute. So he said, I changed my plan, the Brisker Rav said, from learning, which by definition has interruptions, to something where I could sit for 6 hours and, you know, not stop at all. And that's why he went to Tehillim, right? So he actually held that even the Brisker Rav, who certainly could have spent all of his time in very deep learning, thought there was a special inyan in Tehillim. Okay, we'll take one more, and I have to go to another shiur now. Okay, you all have a good week, and we'll see you. Yeah.